Hi, this is Keith Wooden, and welcome to Story Mosaics. This afternoon, this morning, I have the privilege of sitting together with a friend of mine. Mickey, I was counting up the years that we've known each other, and it's 13 years that we've known one another. I met Mickey several years ago when we were on a tour of Israel. And over the years, we've not only formed a professional relationship, but we've formed a personal relationship, a friendship. And I count Mickey as a very good friend. And Mickey is so well-versed in the cultural, the biblical, and insights into what is taking place in Israel that we may not get the clarity on from our own news media. Mickey, we're so used to getting these sound bites of 1 or 2 minutes. And in fact, I hate to say this, but this conflict that is between Iran and Israel sometimes does not even appear in the opening remarks of our media. They've put it third or fourth, or sometimes even back page, so to speak. And so it's alarming what we're seeing here of the fact that we don't seem to understand the gravity or the importance of what is taking place. And that's why I've invited Mickey on today to meet with us in this live broadcast. And first time we've done this in this fashion. If you have a question, you can go ahead and place the question down in the comments, and I'll be able to see those. Several of you did what I'd asked and submitted questions beforehand. And we may need to come back in a week or so because things are transpiring so quickly. Of course, we had notification this morning on our media that what we saw was a rocket from a ballistic rocket that got through the Iron Dome into a bus depot that fortunately was not busy at the moment. But it was one of those moments where we're going, wow, you know, the Iron Dome is phenomenal, but there are rockets that are getting through, and that's partially just because of the number of rockets that are being launched.
Yes, I am in a safe room in case the rockets start falling, and I would like to continue. I need to continue in a safe room. And in my safe room, there's a window, but the window is shut with the metal block, and the door will be shut if the siren goes off. So I cannot see the rockets outside. I do not want to see the rockets outside because that can be life dangerous.
Very good.
When they're intercepted, first, even if they are intercepted, the pieces can fall. And they're very big pieces, and they're very, very heavy. And so that's dangerous. So you are required or instructed by the home front to shut down the window, the door, and that's to avoid any kind of pieces falling or the shock waves or anything of this kind. So that's why. But I do have a television here, and I do have an internet, so I can see what is shown, what is broadcasted by the Israeli television, and that's very helpful. So that helps me to connect to the outside world.
I think they said 350 rockets and then hundreds of drones in the last days since this conflict began. So welcome, Mickey. Good to have you with us, and I'm so thankful for you to be here. Hey, I want to get a little bit of background because you're a guide for tours, but obviously tours are pretty shut down. You also work with the National Park System, but can you give us just a little bit of an insight to your family as well? You jokingly said your wife was going to set you up because she's the tech in the house, right?
That is true.
And how many people are in your home? And you know, tell me a little bit about your family.
Well, I'm 55 years old, and I was born in the USSR. And my family and me, we immigrated to Israel when I was 18. about 36, 37 years ago by now. And I married my child's sweetheart, as you say, a girl that I
Yes.
knew from grade one. And we know each other for almost 50 years. And I cannot hide anything from her, but me and her, we have four beautiful girls, and one, the youngest one, is still with us. She's in high school now. She's almost 17, and then three girls. One is married, one lives in Tel Aviv, and the other one is in the army, so she's in and out of the house. But one is constantly with us, so that's what we are. And you asked me to share something special about my life, and maybe in briefly, if I can say
Please.
that one of the main things that I am dealing with, I was struggling with in my childhood, is what's wrong with being Jewish in the USSR, in Russia. And Russia is famous for its anti-Semitism, old anti-Semitism that went for decades or even centuries, probably. And so we immigrated to Israel, and there was another struggle when we came to Israel. Was a total different experience to us. We came from behind the Iron Curtain. There's some bad things about it. There's some good things about it, which I will tell you in a minute. But here I was also struggling with the identity crisis, because we became Russians here in Israel. And my other struggle was when I found Jesus. Can you maintain your Jewishness if you follow Jesus? And that's something that I was revealed, that you can actually be Jewish and follow Jesus. And this is the story of my life today. So here I am, and I studied history, and I became a tour guide. And actually, history, studying history, helps me to deal with the reality today. But not in the Jewish history. You cannot study Jewish history without the Bible. It's
Yes.
deeply, deeply connected with the scriptures. Even when the Jewish people reject it,
Wow.
it's still connected with the Bible in a very interesting way, because one of the reasons for that is that's how people see you from the outside. They don't see you only as a nation, but they see you also as a religious group. You might not, there's a lot of people in Israel that do not believe in the Bible, the Jewish people, but they're still viewed as the Jews because of this certain, if I may use the word, stereotype, from the outside. And you see this on the internet a lot.
You
But
know,
one thing, okay.
that is so insightful for us to understand, because there's the cultural Jewishness, if you will, but then there's the faith Jewishness, and then you make this big jump between also being a man of faith in Christ in the midst of that. You must have felt a little bit alienated from the people that you're with. When did you come to Christ? I guess let's put that in perspective as well.
Quite soon. When I was 19, maybe, so quite
Okay.
soon after I came to Israel. Actually, it's if I may just jump into history a little bit, and not too far away history, into the history of the Holocaust. We know that the Nazis hated the Jews, but they had to define who is a Jew. That they hated, and they wanted to take actions against. So they had to define who is the Jew, because there were Jewish people that converted to Christianity in Germany in those days, and they had to decide, who are they? Are they Christians? Are they Germans? And it was decided that they're still the Jews, and they
Wow.
should be treated as the Jews, no matter how Christians they are, if they've been converted long ago as children or as adult, matter nothing for the Nazis. And so, but this is just an example of how we the Jews have viewed from the outside world.
Well, let's use that as a jumping off point here briefly. I'll get to some of our listeners' questions in just a moment, but there's the whole identity of Jewishness in this conflict as well, because now Israel, the nation, has been defined as Jewish, and there is a Muslim entity, maybe not all Muslims. In fact, I would say not all Muslims at all, but there is a definition of Jewishness that is within the Muslim world as well. Can you help me out there? Because I don't want to make any assumptions. I'm trying to understand it myself as to what is the heart of the Muslim Israel conflict.
I have 2 points here I might stress that from the pure religious Muslim point of view, the Jews is the religious community. It's a religious community, and the Muslim religion developed the legal system how to relate to that community, just like they developed the legal system how to relate to the Christian community, the same thing
Okay, good.
to the Jewish to the Jewish community. That's on the one hand. However, on the other hand, they viewed by the Muslim world around us in the Middle East, we are viewed as imperialists. And this is not a religious aspect. This is a pure social, economic, political aspect of modernity and nationalism. So we all viewed as part of European imperialism, which is totally wrong. And what is interesting, I was studying a little bit on the Iranian history now. As you know, that Iran is the largest Shia country in the world,
Very
and
important.
there is a deep hatred and war animosity between the Shia and Sunnis. Probably the conflict between the Shias and Sunnis is much deeper, bigger, bloodier than the conflict with the Jews through the history. But what is interesting about Iranian Shia that they became Shia, as you probably know, in 1979. The revolution happened there, which was also very dramatic with the American hostages that were taken in the American embassy. And it was a very dramatic episode in American history, I think, because nothing like this happened in US history before. And what is interesting that not only it was an Islamic component in this revolution, but also very, very leftist, Marxist element in the Iranian society of this time, anti-imperialism, Marxist meaning anti-imperialist, socialist component, which was actually taken over by the Muslim fundamentalists in 4 years, and there is none anymore to today. But it's still there as an ideology. So this is an interesting phenomenon in Iran. In particular, that they have this combination of Muslim fundamentalism and Marxism in the situation when Israel, as a state, and Iran, as a state, never had a conflict. We don't have a common border. We are around 2,000 kilometers, which is 1,500 miles. No, yes, 1,500, 1,600 miles away from each other. We never had a conflict. And so it's not about the land. Unlike our conflict with the Palestinians, it's slightly different because with the Palestinians, like Gaza, we do have a conflict over the land, but it's also connected to conflict with Islam. But this is a different Islam. It's a Sunni Islam, and that's also interesting to observe.
So I want to make sure people understand, and I'm going to tell our listeners, I have recorded Mickey every time I've gone with him on our trips because I always have to go back and listen to what Mickey has said because it's so much content there. But if I'm hearing you correct, the Shia Muslim in Iran, not that old in terms of its leadership, is very, very much anti-Israel. Did I get that correct then? The Shia,
That
okay.
is correct because of this combination with the leftists who saw the West as an enemy,
Yes.
and the only representative of the West now in the Middle East is Israel after the end of real colonial policy of England, France,
Yes.
Russia, and somewhat of the United States.
And we had one of our listeners, in fact, it was Nick from Ireland that was kind of zeroing in on this very aspect because he was wondering what was the cultural issues between these two nations, because historically and culturally, this is a relatively new conflict, if you will, a new hatred that has developed, if you will, towards the Jewish nation in Israel. And when I'm talking about Israel now, I'm talking about the land of Israel. So interesting there, Mickey, to understand that and put that in perspective.
It is new because Israel is a relatively new state. We are the old country, we're the old people around, but we are a relatively young state that is less than 80 years old. Iran is also, in the modern terms, a relatively young state. As well. So it's all part of the building of the national states that Europe and America went through 200, 300 years ago, and we're going through it now,
Wow.
mostly as a result of World War One.
Okay. So it goes back. The history of this is very, very deep. It's why also, Mickey, and I think this has been difficult for people to understand. Like you said, you're 1,600 miles from Iran, and yet this fomenting hatred is so strong. And yet you have Jordan that is your neighbor who you live in a peaceful relationship with or have for many years. Barring 1967 and those types of areas. And you have Saudi Arabia who you've gained a working relationship with. And so this is centered in Iran, and that's the conflict that we're seeing today. We had one of our listeners, though, pinpoint her question. This was Deborah, and she lives on the West Coast here in the United States. And her, I'm sorry, no, this was Carol, who lives in the Midwest actually here. And she had a one-word question, which was why? And then she wrote, why now? Why is this taking place? Here we had what was going on in Gaza, and yet Netanyahu and the leaders felt like this was an imminent threat. So is that, help me understand what was taking place that just less than a week ago, if I can wrap my mind around this, less than a week ago, we had this war begin, and I've called it a conflict. Others have called it a war. Iran has called it a war. In fact, they've said that it was a declaration of war. Why now, as you look at it historically and in its context today?
Iran, if we're talking about Israel-Iran conflict, Iran sees itself as the regional superpower. And there is a history to that. If you go to the biblical days,
Thank you.
we know that during the Old Testament period, the Persian Empire, which is Iran, actually occupied a very vast territory, including Israel of those days. We talking the 6th century BC, 5th century BC, for a couple of hundred years. They were the largest foreign empire in the biblical days. There were other empires, like the Babylonian Empire, for example, which the Persians conquered,
That's right.
but they were not as big as Persia. There was Egyptian Empire, as we know from the earlier, a little bit earlier biblical history. Persians conquered Egypt as well. So they ruled Egypt. They ruled Levant, which is Israel, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, all those modern countries. They ruled Babylon, which is Mesopotamia. Okay, but they also ruled parts of Europe. They ruled what is Turkey today, Asia Minor, and they also ruled mainland Greece.
Wow.
And so they were the largest empire around, and this is part of the Persian history. They're very proud of that, and they want it back now because of the Shia Muslim ideology that they have. And the ideology, if I can be very, very brief, it's part of Islamic ideology. According to the world view of Islam, the world is divided into two sections, which is called the world of Islam and the world that will be Islam. Well,
I'm
and
laughing,
you
but
can understand, I'm not joking.
no, I
I'm not
understand.
joking. I'm very serious about it, and you can understand this. And they have two approaches to that. Because they view that the Islam is the correct way or true way or the only way to the righteous kingdom of Allah. And you can either become part of this kingdom peacefully if you are convinced to see that this is the true way. So you can join and you can become part of Ummah. You can become part of the Muslim nation, like many nations did here. For example, if you take the part of Israel, when the Muslims conquered Israel, there were no Jews here, very, very few Jews here. They were mostly Eastern Roman Christians. And most of them became Muslims. Most of them became Muslims from the pure economic reasons that the life was easy and better if you're Muslim. And so you can either become a Muslim, or we will conquer you, or we will make you Muslim by force. And amongst the Muslim, they believe that Shia is the right shape or form of Muslim religion. And so that's why the Iranians see this in two ways. A, to restore the imperial past. And that should not surprise you. The Russians want to do the same, for example. On the one hand, but on the other hand, the overall idea is Muslim. The idea of the entire world to become Muslim. So, and that's the conflict. If we don't, and we declare this land as the Jewish land. By the way, there's another part to that. Another part of Islam, you can see that once Muslim, always Muslim. In other words, if the territory once was Muslim and for some reason was taken back by somebody else, no matter who that is, it's a religious duty. First of all, religious duty to bring it back to the realm of Islam. Again, you can bring it peacefully if people agree. But if they don't agree, so you have a religious duty. It's your religious duty to bring it back. And there's a word which is, again, has a very, very wide definition. The word is jihad. Okay, but it's again, we and that's one of the problems with the
That's
media.
right.
We need to define the terms. What are we talking about, people? Because it just sounds so cool, jihad, you know, but it's a concept. It's a deep concept. You have to study this. You have to see what the aspects of this concept, etc., etc. But that's the conflict. If we're going back to the question, that's the conflict, and that's why this conflict can be very deep, and it's hard to kill the ideology. Whether it's a Marxist, as you can see, whether it's a Marxist ideology, it's hard to kill. And that's going back to the United States. me, is the one who lived behind the Iron Curtain and escaped the Iron Curtain, defected the Iron Curtain to see in what I would see the beacon of freedom, which is the United States, always been for people like me to see that they are actually, there are people in the States that are sharing the communist ideology and sharing it violently, and there are some Jewish people in it. For me, that makes no sense. It makes no sense at all for me. So it's hard to kill the ideology, and that's our conflict today.
And so again, what you've outlined here is we think always in the immediate sense. What we have to understand is that this it goes much deeper than just an immediacy. It goes back into history. And this, Mickey, this is why my heart beats with yours, is because I'm a historian, and when I look at these conflicts and when I look at these events, I don't see them just in the context of a nuclear bomb issue. I see it much broader than that. And that's what I think our listeners need to understand, is the nuclear issue is only one small, if you will, dot on the bigger picture of what is taking place. Am I getting that right, Mickey?
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. But the reason we are dealing with this dot now, because this dot can be deadly dangerous.
Yes.
If that dot becomes nuclear, if then it then they have this power to implement that, and it's in their ideology, and this is very and that's very dangerous.
Well, and it's as you've said, Islam, by convincing, or if you will, I'll use a Western term, evangelism, Islam by evangelism. Oxymoron there, by the way, but or Islam by force. And when we read about what took place in Egypt, among the Coptic Christians there, they were given the opportunity to confess and say there is no God but Allah, and that would make them Muslim if they just made that confession. Or they could literally lose their heads by confessing that no, there is no God but Yahweh, there is no God but Christ. And so we understand that that dot, that nuclear dot, becomes another means of reaching their pinnacle of a world dominated by this ideology. And I thank you for using the word ideology. Because I think that was an important, and you always use your words very carefully. One of the things that Mickey is famous for in our tours with him is he will always tell us what the etymology, the history, the root of the word means. And when he uses his words, he's using them very carefully. And so Islam, in part of this, is not just a religious now, it is an ideology as well. So thank you for clarifying that, Mickey. Okay, I'm going to press on a little bit, although we're on a good train, and I think these what we'll talk about, we'll continue to talk about, will help. One of the things is that as we've mentioned, you're in a safe room right now. And that is because the conflict is at your doorstep. Do you feel free to tell us the general area in which you live? I mean, is that a safe thing for you to talk about?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no problem with that. What I've learned through guiding tourists from the United States mostly is that the American people do not have a concept of how small Israel is. That
That's
Israel is
helpful.
so we are by the size of New Jersey. In size and in population. And if you take, for example, Iran, can you imagine Iran is 80 times bigger?
No
80,
way.
80 times bigger. If we are close around 10 million people here, both Jews and Arabs that are living here in Israel, they are about 100 million, or close to that, in Iran. So they're 10 times bigger in population, and they're 80 times bigger in the territory. So very little wonder that they want to dominate. They want to become a superpower. What is fortunate for us that not only them want to become a superpower, the others that want to be the superpowers. And oftentimes the international, and I'm serious again now, the international politics here in the Middle East is based on this one principle. The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Say that again, because I think that's so important.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend. In other words, we build alliances. For example, Israel builds alliances based on the fact that we have a common interest. It's a common enemy in that case. And I think this is one of the reasons that the Sunni countries like the United Arab Emirates, as Saudis in a certain respect, made a deal with Israel, not because they like Israel, not because we share the same values, but because we have the same common enemy. And
Wow.
we're going back to history, to the Sunni Shia conflict, and Iran definitely wants to dominate this region. But you have, for example, Turkey, that is been an empire, also very, very large empire, probably bigger than the Iranian Empire, but not in a biblical time, in the modern time. The Ottoman Turkish Empire was very large, and the Middle East was dominated by the Ottoman Turkish Empire, but not Iran. But Israel was, we were under the Ottomans for 400 years, 400 years up until the end of World War I. From 1517 to 1917, we were part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and they want to dominate. I'll just give you one very, very little example, which is, I think, can be interesting in this aspect, and that's example of Syria and the change of the regime
I
in
was going to
Syria
ask about this. Yes.
when the dictator of Syria, which was Sunni, wait, excuse me, which was Shia kind. She was a Shia, it was not a pure Shia, but Shia kind was knocked off and replaced by the Sunnis, in our case, radical Sunni groups. There was a chaos in Syria, and we're talking just a few months ago. This is a very recent history as well, just everybody forgotten about it because things are changing here so very quickly. But and so when the Assad regime fell, and he ran away to guess where? To Moscow, right?
Oh,
Going back
yes.
to the socialist slash communist Marxist ideology. So he goes back to Moscow, and then the Kurds, which is a powerful economically and militarily country now, immediately wanted to move in this vacuum that appeared, and wanted to establish, not maybe not conquer Syria, but establish their military rule and make it a proxy for Turkey, a puppet state for Turkey. Israeli military was so much against it, and they were
Wow.
able to convince our Prime Minister Netanyahu to not to allow the Turks to establish their military bases in proximity to the Golan Heights and Israeli borders. Netanyahu was very, very cautious, and I can understand this because he looks at it from the political point of
Yes.
view, and he didn't want to mess up with the powers here in the Middle East and whatnot. But the military was so persistent, and they said we got to push the Turks away. And actually, the Israeli Air Force immediately started to bomb the military bases and weapons in Syria, and trying to establish somewhat of invisible wall between us, Israel, and Turkey on the Syrian territory. And we were successful in that. We were successful in that.
It's phenomenal.
And this actually allowed us today to have this corridor in the air to fly directly to Iran. We need to fly there for almost 2 hours. Our jets have to fly for 2 hours without being shot on the way from the anti-aircraft systems that the Turks have. If the Turks would have their bases close to the Golan Heights, close to the Israeli border, our airplanes would be the target. And so we would not today, and we would not be so successful today as we are because of this constant concern of the Turkish missiles and the aircrafts that can fly and interfere into our missions. This is just one little example of this kind of relationship, the politics that we have.
And I think you've made a very good distinction just in one word. Because, like in Israel, you said, in Israel, among the Jews and the Arabs, there is a harmony of many people in Israel today among the Jews and the Arabs that is a working harmony. It's not antagonistic. And in fact, as you've witnessed and I've witnessed in you, you have a working relationship with many Arabs, you know, that many Arabs that you work intimately with. And so this is, let's not posture this simply into an Arab-Israeli conflict based on your one statement about the enemy of my friend. Or how did you phrase that again? Help me out, phrase that one
The
more
enemy
time.
of the enemy is my friend.
Yes. And so there's a working relationship. And I think that's what's been established with Jordan as well, in many ways. Am I correct?
May I say no?
Okay, you may.
Jordan is a different story altogether. Again, our relationship with Jordan, Israel-Jordan relationship, is based on the same principle. The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yes.
It's not based on the principle of sharing the mutual values.
That's right.
They do not share the same values, and we see this in their political system. It's a monarchy. A monarchy today can be just a different word for dictatorship. Dictators not necessarily can be hereditary, and monarchy is hereditary. Maybe that's the only difference. It's a minor difference, but in essence, it's not a true democracy, but it's a dictatorship, okay, type of society. And Jordan is very poor, and they need to survive in amongst the super. Jordan was never a superpower. It was never a country called Jordan before World War I.
That's
It was
right. That's
always
right.
part of something else. The territory was part of a bigger kingdom, of another kingdom. So they just got this as a part of the division of Turkey in 1917. In 1917, when World War I finished, and with the Versailles Conference and some other treaties, this new country of Jordan was established in 1921. So it's a new. It's not like Iran. It's a new country. It's a very small country. Plus, it has zero natural resources.
Oh, I was
Zero
not aware of that.
natural
Okay.
resources. There is no oil. There is no gas. There's not even enough water. It's mostly desert country. Iran, for example, has the largest gas in the world, reserves in the world. Iran, if I'm not mistaken, like the second largest reserves of oil. So they have this natural resources, and that's why they could establish this, big country, and they have big ambitions because they have money from this resource. The Jordanians are not like this. They don't have anything like that. And I think what they want is the royal family just want to ensure their survival through the
Okay.
generations.
Yes.
And they also have a conflict between the Bedouin. I hope I corrupt this word the way you corrupt this Arabic word. So they have a conflict between the shepherds, the nomadic people, the Bedouins, and the farmers, the farming people that call themselves Palestinians, but the Arabs in essence. It's a different conflict that is also a very ancient conflict. We can see this in the Bible also. And so they have a constant inner conflict when the minority kind of rule the majority, when they have this royal family that is in essence a dictatorship there, and they have no resources. And so that's why they know if they want to get the money or the kind of resources, they can get it from the West, either from England, but mostly from the United States now after World War II. But the way to Washington goes through Jerusalem, oftentimes, and that's why they had to build a relationship with Jerusalem on the one hand. But on the other hand, they have also a major Palestinian question as well. There were a number of cases when the Palestinians that lived there wanted to make a revolution, a coup against the regime. So they do have some history of brutal fighting with the Palestinians, for example. So I would not say that Israel has a good relationship with Jordan because we share the same values. We have quiet relationship. Can I
Yes.
call it cold peace? We have a term, Cold War, but this is a term called the Cold Peace. Okay, which is better than the war. Oh, for
Yes.
Israel, it's from our perspective, it's we're gaining the peace, and that's a good thing. Let it be cold. Maybe it is cold, but it is peace, at least for now. And so it might seem that we have good relationship, but that's not exactly true.
I think that is a great. I'm going to emphasize that cold peace, COLDPEACE, cold peace, not cold war. And so that's a good definitive term. Let's just talk about this for a moment because I'm watching our time fleet by, and this is just going way too fast, Mickey. But that's okay because the content is so rich. But one of our viewers had asked, do you recognize the possibility for this erupting into not just a regional conflict, but a much larger conflict? You have Turkey. You've already talked about Turkey, who's a part of NATO, and NATO has this agreement that if you attack one, you attack us all, and that's why it's been very important for the Ukraine to say we want to be a part of NATO. That's been part of this driven force of the Ukraine saying we want to be a part of that. Well, we have alliances and we have these relationships that are very tenuous at the time. Does the man on the street in Israel recognize what is at stake here of going from a regional to a more complex conflict? Is that, do you understand my question? Does that make any sense?
I think so. I think so. Because Israel is a democracy, and going back to your previous question of Jewish people and Arab people living in Israel side by side, that is because Israel's foundation is built on the same foundation as the United States of Western democracies. We recognize the right of the minorities. We recognize the equal rights of the citizens, etc. Everything that you share, we share here, and that's why we have my children have no problem living with the Arab children. That's how my children have been educated, but that's not how the Arab children have been educated, unfortunately. So it's because of the foundation of the state of Israel we have this democracy, and having this democracy, we have a freedom of speech, okay, and a freedom of press, and that's why we have access to the resources to we see every day the debates on the television or the internet. We have different opinions, this opinion, that opinion. And that is maybe going back to the question that you presented before. It's a very fundamental, the freedom of press and the freedom of the access to the information is a very, very fundamental principle. People asking, oftentimes they ask me on the tour also, what is the reliable source that I can get this information? And it's a very difficult question, okay? May I say, Joe, do we have a minute for a joke
Yes.
here on the program? I really would recommend people, first of all, to find on YouTube the collection of jokes that the famous American president had, Ronald Reagan, had a
Yes.
collection of the Soviet jokes. They are phenomenal. He tells them much better than I would tell you because he was a professional actor and I'm not. I'm an amateur actor. But when I grew up behind the Iron Curtain, right? That's the time of the USSR. Ronald Reagan said this joke. He said two journalists met together, American and the Russian one, and the American journalist said to the Russian journalist, said, "Well, how can you become a journalist if you don't have a freedom of speech in Russia? In America, I have a freedom of speech. I can come to the White House, I can come to the American president, and I can criticize him for the policy. I can say, well, American, you're stupid, you're wrong, you're dumb." And the Russian guy said, "Well, I have even more freedom. I can come to Kremlin. I can knock to the door. I can walk into the Brezhnev's office and say, 'American president is stupid. He's done, dumb. He's absolutely nonsense.'" Okay, so that's so
That's the
much for the
freedom of
freedom of
press in
speech
Israel. I mean,
in
in
no, not in
USSR.
the dictatorships, in the dictatorships like Russia or Iran, or North Korea. Or countries like this, and lots of American people take it for granted. They shouldn't. They
We
shouldn't.
do.
That's one thing. But I do have another joke, also the same collection of Ronald Reagan jokes. They were two major newspapers behind the Iron Curtain in the USSR. One was called the Pravda. Pravda is a Russian word for truth. It's the name of the newspaper. Okay, and the second largest newspaper was Izvestia, which is the Russian word for news. So the joke goes, there was no truth in the news, and there was no news in the
The
truth.
truth.
Okay, but there's this one positive thing about it that I took with me from my childhood upbringing, that because you cannot trust the state media. There's just doesn't matter which newspaper you read, whether you either read the truth or you read the news, you can't trust them. So you learn to read between the lines, okay, and you learn to research the information,
Yes.
okay. You cannot expect. When I grew up, I couldn't expect to say, well, this is it. This is this one source, and that's it. You had to research for that, and that was one of my sort of pushes for history studies, because I always wanted to get to the the core of whatever problem there was. So I know this is a difficult answer, and one of the problems in my line of work that I'm really afraid to give small answers to big questions. It's a big question. It
Yes, it
is a big
is.
question, and I'm not trying to be critical. I'm just, as an outsider, as a viewer, I can just point out that the Western democracies, and especially in American culture, we are expected to receive something that we paid for. Okay, I'm hungry. I want a burger. So I'm not going to cook it. I'm going to go to McDonald's. I'm going to pay 10 bucks and I'm going to get this burger, which is ready. It's already there. It's packed and there's a meal there. There is a French fries and the drink there. Everything is prepared for me and I will be fed. By the way, it's not only about the news and media, it's also about the Bible. People are looking
Yes.
for immediate answers for big questions or difficult questions in the Bible, and they come to Israel and they want to see the answer to this. For example, why there's evil in the world? Oh my God! I at the university they didn't tell me why there is evil in the world. I don't know. What am I supposed to tell these people? But they pay their money, Keith. They pay 5,000 grands for crying out loud. They want to know the answer. Why there's so much evil in the world? If I'm not providing them the answer, then I'm not doing my professional work. Okay, I'm not professional enough. So this is, and I always advise people and tell them when they come to Israel, this is just the beginning. This is not the end of journey. You are in the journey. So search for it, and they might be different answers for different people, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I think this is so critical, so absolutely critical, because what we've found ourselves in the United States right now is we have these streams and these diets of people that they only receive one information stream. And because of that, they only have one ideology, they only have one thought. And they people all the time ask me why I listen to multiple different streams of information, all of which are in their mind in conflict with one another. And I say that's exactly why, because I cannot trust, if you will, the information on one stream. I cannot drink my water just from one source. I have to get that resource from many different areas. And so some of them say, well, you listen to liberal ideas? Absolutely. I listen to conservative ideas? Absolutely. You listen to nationalist ideas? Absolutely. I listen to all of this. And then I'm able to do what you've said. I can go to history. And I think, you and I have this heartbeat together. I can go to history and see the strains of history and how it's played out in the past out of these same informational ideas and ideologies. And so I want to make sure that people recognize this and understand this. Can I go to a very practical level here as we're getting ready to wrap it up? But I want to go to a very practical level. You're li living in the West Bank there, which is traditionally a Palestinian area. And as you said, my children grew up with the Palestinian children, the Arab children, and they had relationships and friendships and the like. And you also are in a situation where you work a great deal in Jerusalem. You know, half of the trip that we take when we come to Israel is focused on Jerusalem. And then we have the city of Tel Aviv. And we have the focal point of most of the drones and the rockets are at Tel Aviv, not at Jerusalem in particular. And of course, I hold a little piece of this in my heart that one of the reasons why they would not attack Jerusalem is because it has a holy site for Islam. The Dome of the Rock is right there, and you don't want to destroy that. That would not be a good thing with a rocket from Iran to destroy the Dome of the Rock. So I've always felt a little bit safer in Jerusalem to one degree or another. But practically, you have a daughter that's living in Tel Aviv. And so I know your heart beats for Tel Aviv. You have a daughter that's in the military. And I remember at one point while we were on a bus, we drove by an area where your daughter had been stationed for a period of time. And you also talked about the Gazan border years ago, and how this was a volatile area for the stations of the military. So we have these areas that your family is in. And so I know that when you go to bed or when you go through the day, and we know that the nighttime is the time of most of the attacks, when you close your eyes, you have to have a faith in someone who is greater than what you can do in protecting your family. You do rely on the Lord, and you rely on the faith, and you rely on those prayers. And we want to make sure you know, Mickey, that when we're coming to this moment, we recognize that you are not only a historian, you're not only a very wise man and insightful man, but you're a father and you're a husband. And so we want you, Mickey, to know that we are praying for you and your family. And you could do us a favor as well, Mickey. You could convey to them the fact that we are praying for them, that we do hold them in prayer in this moment as well. And if you would you just tell us the first names of each of your daughters and your wife so that we can just record that and know that we can pray for them as well?
Well, my wife's name is Minnie, because I'm Mickey, so my wife's name is no. That's an old Soviet joke. No, that's not true. But her name is Laura, and she's the 4-star general. She's a chief of staff here.
She is.
We do what she tells us to, and then. My oldest daughter, she's 31, and she lives now at Beersheba. She was a lieutenant in Israeli military. Now she is a licensed psychologist, and she treats the soldiers now, those who have the syndromes and all sorts of disorders due to the war. And she's married, and she lives in Beersheba. And then my second daughter, Naomi, she's 25. She's a art history student in Tel Aviv, and that's the kid that lives by herself in Tel Aviv. I don't know what she's going to do with the art history. Well, I have no clue, but that's maybe another thing for
That's
prayer.
not, yeah,
That's
that's
as
right.
a father, just. God, give me the revelation. What can she do with this degree? And then Ada, she's 21. She's in the military. And she actually finished her mandatory service, because we have both male and female mandatory service. So she finished the mandatory service, but she stayed in the army since the beginning of the conflict. And she is with the department that deals with all the casualties. So she has seen certain things on the 7th and 8th and 9th of October that we don't want to see. And but she's okay. She's coping with that. And then we have the youngest daughter is Tamar, so she's almost 17, and she is with us now at home. So
Wow.
that's our
Thank
family.
you. And I'd ask our viewers just to mark those names down, write those down, and pray for not only the peace of Jerusalem, not only the peace of Israel, but to pray for this family that now you've got to know. And we want to make sure that we're a part of praying for you, Mickey, and the family. And if I'm not mistaken, and I may be wrong on this, but was there a time, because you were in the reserves for a long period of time, and was there a time where your daughter outranked you when you were in the reserves?
Oh, absolutely. I actually have to salute all of them, because they all overranked me. And
And
this is a little embarrassing. One more thing for prayer. I'm praying for three husbands. So if there are any candidates between the age of 20 and 35, please let me know. We will discuss that issue.
we'll discuss this. This is not, I don't want to get this into a Fiddler on the Roof matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Okay. So,
Amen.
oh, Mickey, it's been so good to be with you. We've had a lot of questions come up while we were online here. Okay. They've entered them in the comments and things. I'm just going to reserve the right, if you will, to get in touch with you again and do this again. Because this is a volatile situation. It's a constant changing landscape that we're in. And Mickey, I'm going to impose upon you as my friend to come to us again and do this because this has been so informative and so valuable. So, and I thank all of you on Story Mosaics that have joined us in this time. And I ask again that you would be in prayer for the family. And I'm so glad that you joined us to be a part of Story Mosaics.